To start things off, let me introduce you to Colby Bazell and Jack Lewis, two men who have served you and me in the military of the United States, served over in Iraq, and both are featured in one of the episodes of an outstanding upcoming PBS documentary series. It's called America at a Crossroads. It'll be airing the week of April 15th, five straight nights. They'll be airing at least a dozen different independent documentaries. And one of those nights, I believe it'll be the second night, there'll be an hour-long documentary called Operation Homecoming, Writing the Wartime Experience. Both of these guys, while serving, also wrote about their experiences there, caught a little flack for doing so, but also wrote some rather remarkable stories. Gentlemen, welcome to the show, and thank you for your service.
Thank you, Paul.
It's a pleasure having you here. Colby, let me start with you, because you're the one who really caught the most flack, I guess, because you started a blog while you were serving in Iraq as part of the Stryker Brigade combat team as an Army specialist over there. And tell me why you started writing, and how does that work? Do you take a laptop with you to Iraq?
No. Well, now you can. Now I heard there's a lot of people going out there with laptops. But I was there for the second year of the war. And at the time, there was internet cafes all over. Every base has at least a couple internet cafes that are open 24 hours a day. And I was reading an article in Time magazine that was discussed talking about blogs, and I've never even heard the word blog before this. So I read it and then just decided just to start a blog, just out of boredom, just writing about my experience, about what I was seeing. And I just wrote about, you know, a couple of posts every day about, you know, today we did this, today we did that. And that's how I got involved with the Operation Homecoming project, was I was blogging about it, and people were emailing me back in the States saying to submit some writing to it. And at the time, I wasn't too confident with my writing, so I didn't submit anything. But then I got an email from somebody at the National Endowment of the Arts who suggested that I submit something.
Do you have any idea how your writing got to all these people? Because, you know, anybody can start a blog. I've got one. Thousands of millions of Americans, as far as I know, may have blogs at this point. How did yours get attention?
I have no idea. I mean, well, I do. I wrote about a firefight that got not a lot of press back home in the States and any of the big news media outlets. And I just wrote about it, and then people back home, I guess, read it, and then they emailed people about it, and they emailed people about it, and then next thing you know, I was getting 10,000-plus hits a day, you know, and, you know, email boxes flooded with emails, so it was pretty much overnight, you know, it blew up.
And then once it got popular, the Army shut you down?
Yeah, they were kind of nervous, you know, here's a soldier writing about what's going on from the front lines onto the internet for anybody to read. And, you know, I understand their concerns. They don't want a soldier giving out information or getting anybody possibly hurt or injured. So when they told me to pull the plug on my blog, I, you know, pulled the plug on it.
Had you been giving away sensitive information?
No.
I would think that while you're there, you would, as a guy who's right in the middle of it, who's fighting the war, you would be especially sensitive to not giving away operational information.
Yeah, I was really careful. I never mentioned times, locations, left names out. I was just really vague about everything. And sometimes I would even change information on my blog to just in case. And this is even before I got found out, because before then I was doing it anonymously.
Were you writing things that the Army didn't think kindly of?
Maybe. I mean, no. I mean, I was just writing what I was seeing. I was staying away from, you know, throwing in my opinion in there. But I wasn't also gung-ho about the whole thing by then.
Mm-hmm. And were you writing as a way to relieve stress as well?
For me, it was therapeutic to write mm-hmm. about what I was going through. You know, it was kind of like talking to a shrink, kind of. You know, you sit down on a keyboard and you just kind of write what you're seeing and get it all out. And then people would read it and comment back to you. And in a way, they'd be analyzing what you were going through and seeing. So it kind of helped you put a perspective on what you're going through.
Jack, tell me about your experience. Was it similar to Colby's?
No, not really too similar. The reason I was, I had a little list of people that I would send things to. And I basically would write a letter to mom and everyone else kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because we had one little tent out there that was a good long hike from where we were hooched up. and I couldn't get there but maybe twice, three times a week. Given our schedule, we were on a kind of a crusty little fob out ways west of where Colby was.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, I needed to be able to tell certain people that I cared about that I was doing okay, that things were going on. If they didn't hear from me, they got concerned. Well, somewhere along the way, one of my friends batched up one of those emails and sent it off to the NEA, who then sent me a note, an email saying, "Hey, you know, thanks for your submission."
Surprised the heck out of you because you hadn't submitted anything.
Correct. And then I ended up sending them, I don't know, half a dozen more pieces of just these bits of information that I would offload, partly to get them off my chest and partly just to kind of wave my arm and say, "Hey, we're still alive out here."
Mm-hmm. Was part of it also for both of you that you wanted to get part of the story out that you didn't think was being covered?
For me, no, that wasn't initially the reason why I was writing about what was going on. I was constantly going out on missions, so I had no real idea really how the media was reporting the war until I started blogging, and then I started comparing and contrasting what was being said by the Army Public Affairs and by the media, and then it hit me. But previous to that, I had no idea.
Let's talk about that for a second, because I hear from people all the time, "Oh, the media in the United States is only telling the bad side of the war." And then I talk to guys who've come back there who do want to talk about their experiences, and they say, "If you think that's the bad side, you don't know what the bad side is.
You don't know, Jack."
is that true?
I think it's maybe subtler than that. What media tend to do when they get there is they go to the same areas repeatedly, and they ask the same questions again and again. As opposed to, well, this project kind of gets, I think, perspectives from people who are just intimately involved, and no matter how embedded you are with a unit, you didn't train with them. It's not your guys that get sent out to get shot at.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the same thing.
And you're going to leave as a reporter. You're going to leave.
Sure, and you're going to stay in a hotel at least part of the time you're there. And, you know, you fly over there coach, not C-17 web seat.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different thing. And I think if you really want, to flesh out the story, you can get the bones of the story from the media. But if you want, you can get the details, you can get the casualty counts. If you want to flesh out the story, you need to color it in with the experiences of people who actually had those experiences and have given those forth while it's still fresh in their minds.
Colby, after you started blogging and people in America started taking note of what you were writing about, did you hear from people in the media saying, "I want to talk to you, I want to write about your stories"?
Yeah, I got some press while I was over there, NPR, Wall Street Journal, Associated Press, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of times, they would just, ask me a couple questions. There was a time when, I'd have to go down the phone center every other day to do an interview
mm-hmm.
with someone back home, and I'd have to schedule out, okay, I got an interview here tomorrow, I'm doing that.
Right.
This, and so that was kind of surreal,
How'd your sergeant feel about that?
The other guys at platoon are, what's going on here?
Mr. Popularity, phone call again. Yeah, we'll be over here just eating sand while you're talking back to America. Very nice.
Yeah. That's interesting.
And Jack, when you wrote about it, did you get acclaim from the people in your own unit for what was being published, or were they not even aware of what you were doing?
My unit was a long way from me.
Oh, yeah?
My unit sliced off a detachment of a dozen and a half of us that went over, who were then separated out into little teams. And, I had my two guys with me to support a squadron.
Mm.
And they didn't care as long as they got their 3 hours of sleep a night.
3 hours of sleep a night?
We were busy boys.
Tell me a little bit about your story, which is called Roadwork. I watched the show this morning, and it's a rather intense story of a man whose son you're the troops around you killed. You didn't kill them. But the guys around you supposedly killed this guy's son, and
it was a road accident, actually.
Oh, okay.
Have I seen people killed that may or may not have been guilty of, well, anything? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
This was not somebody who was intentionally killed.
Mm-hmm.
We were blowing up the road from Sinjar back toward Talifar in a convoy of strikers. And we were running in blackout, fairly good clip.
Mm-hmm.
And they literally never saw it coming. It just tore the car in half.
Mm-hmm. And that was the end of it. And then here's this guy comes into the street wailing.
Well, I don't want to say miracle because that sounds too positive, but the really strange thing is this: the father who was in the car was really not that banged up, and his son was like a ticket torn in half.
Mm-hmm. And as a parent, you could relate to a parent losing their child. Isn't that part of what you wrote about?
I could, yeah.
Yeah. Amazing firsthand experiences, which are part of this documentary. Colby, your I guess, I don't know, famous or infamous piece was called Men in Black, in which you're riding along in the tank and you look over to the side and here's a guy with an AK-47 pointed at you and he's pulling the trigger.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember looking over to my left and seeing this guy just stepping out of the edge of this building with this AK-47 pointing directly at me. And I remember I froze for a second because I was, you know, you don't see that every day. And mm-hmm. then, like, you see that. And then you see the fire leaving the end of the barrel. And then that's when the alarm started going off in my head, like, you know, get down, you know. So I jumped down and, you know, all this confusion's going on. And I look over my platoon sergeant who's, you know, the vehicle. There's two people sticking out of the hatches. He's to my left. I look over, and he's completely, like, on the ground. I thought he was dead, you know. He was just looked knocked out and laying on his back. And I look over, and I'm thinking he's dead, but I don't see any blood. But he takes off his helmet. Well, there's two holes in his helmet, one on the left side and one on the right. And he takes off his helmet, observes it, puts his finger in the holes, and feels his head. And I guess the bullet went through his helmet, and it just, like, barely missed his forehead and went out, and he
didn't even graze him.
Didn't even graze him, but it just gave him a concussion. But then he just put the helmet back on, strapped up, and got back out of the hatch. And we drove through the ambush, and that's basically what happened. We drove through the ambush. We're taking fire from all over. We drive through it, and we think, you know, we're like, thank God we made it. But then we get orders to go back and take care of the neutralize the streets. We load up in the vehicles. We drive back. Long story short, we're shooting, and then finally the whole thing's calmed down. And then the Iraqi police and the Iraqi army comes over and they start clearing buildings. And then I actually wrote that piece the day after and that event happened. I went down the internet cafe and I thought, you know, I'll do some Google searches. I'll check some websites. Maybe it'll be big news all over the back home. And I couldn't find anything really on any websites or anywhere that said anything about what happened that day. And that kind of it kind of made me upset. You know, here's this event that happened that a lot of people almost got killed. Two people severely wounded. Lieutenant Armini took an RPG in the stomach that day. And, you know, there's hardly any reports of it to people back home about it. So I just cut and pasted what CNN wrote on their website, which is just like a paragraph that said, you know, today in Mosul, some fighting went on. You know, pretty much saying nothing happened. I cut and pasted that, and I wrote, here's what CNN wrote. And then I wrote, now here's what really happened. And I just started from the beginning. You know, I was sitting in my room reading a book when the mortars started coming down, and then just went from there to the experience of what happened that day. And then I remember posting it up on the blog and not really thinking much of it. I was just, like, relieved that I got it out there. And like, you know, towards the end, I was getting tired of typing. So I was like, you know, hurry up, finish this thing. and then I posted it up on there. It was like, I want to say like 6,000 words or 7,000. I don't know. It was pretty long. But I just posted it up on there. And then after that, I remember just smoking a cigarette and going to the chow hall with with a friend and not thinking much of it until the next day. And then all of a sudden I look at my emails and, you know, it's, yeah, I guess people kind of, you know, people want to know about what's going on over there in Iraq. They want to hear about, you know, firsthand soldier, you know, perspectives of the war. You know, they want to hear stories from, you know, the people. You know, people are so desensitized by, like, these sound clips from, like, you know, today in Baghdad, car bomb went off, 10 dead, 3 wounded or something like that. You know, there's no, you know, we're so used to that that we have no idea what actually happened that day, you know, how scared somebody was that day. And, you know, people need to hear about that sort of stuff.
Absolutely, absolutely. I wrote down a couple of things that I don't know if they were attributed to you two guys or to others who were on that series. One of them was that gunfire on a Thursday afternoon means a wedding party. What does that mean?
See, I was in the infantry, and you know, we'd always go on patrols, and whenever we hear gunfire, like at weddings, I don't know if it was Wednesday. It seemed like it was whenever they wanted to, but sometimes it was like gunfire is a common thing. I mean, every night, you know, you're constantly hearing gunfires or seeing tracers fired up in the air. And I remember the first time I encountered a situation like that was when we were in the Sunni Triangle. And, you know, there was all of a sudden there was all this shooting going up in the air, and we're seeing some tracers go up in the air. So we go in and investigate it. And at first we were just going to, you know, destroy that block, you know. But we went over there, and we had our interpreters go take a look. And I guess it was a wedding. I guess at weddings what they like to do is get their guns out and shoot up in the air.
Test gravity?
Yeah.
And, yeah, we had a simpler rule, which was if it was going vertical, we worried a lot less about it.
Good rule.
Yeah. I guess that's something you have to be able to be on the site to know if it's going vertical or not.
It's easier to tell at night.
Oh, yeah, because you could probably, yeah, I could see that. Did you guys have to learn Arabic while you were there, or at least a little bit, so that you could get along with some of the locals?
That's like anywhere else you travel. You learn, you know, a few words
mm-hmm.
about it. You know,
yeah, I was shocked about how little Arabic training we got before we got sent over there. You know, we're going, being deployed for at least a year, you would think they would at least spend some time teaching us a little bit of Arabic. But from what I remember, we only got one day of formal Arabic training, and then we, you know, we get handed this little piece of paper that has these little phrases of.
That's what we got, the little cheat card.
Yeah,
we didn't get the one day either.
You didn't get that before you went over?
Yeah. No, and we were supposed to disseminate information. That was our job.
How did you do that if you don't speak Arabic?
Terps and preprints.
Mm-hmm.
And we built a radio station and hoped that the people we brought on were saying the right thing.
But had no way to verify that.
We had ways to verify that.
Okay, while you were there. Did you experience anti-Americanism on a large scale from the locals? I'm not just talking about the people who had guns who were going to be shooting at you, but I'm talking about in everyday experience when you'd go through a neighborhood.
I always get asked that, and I don't know how to answer that, because we'd go on patrols and we'd go through neighborhoods, and you know, it 1 minute they're waving at you, and the next minute they're throwing rocks at you. It's hard to get a feel of, and plus there's a language barrier there. And then, you know, a lot of the interpreters we have were Iraqis, but, you know, they're working for us. Of course they're going to tell you that they're all for us being there. And but from a lot of people that you can talk to, you know, they're for you. But, like, you know, so many times you get flipped off, you get, you know, by somebody, or get a rock thrown, or you know, who knows what. But it's hard to, it's you know, for me it was impossible to get a real feel of how they overall felt about us being there.
It depends on the neighborhood, and you kind of learn which blocks are automatically a combat patrol kind of thing. Before we left Mosul, we had when we'd go across town from MAF. We had this one kid we'd always pass, and he was hawking, you know, like used newspapers and old cans or something on the side of the street. And every single time we went by, he'd give us the finger. And, you know, it's a kid. What are you going to do? So one day I hate to admit this, but we had every gunner for this four-vehicle convoy, every gunner loaded up a water balloon And I went by, and he just got doused four times in a row. And the next time I went by, he was grinning and waving. It was, I don't know, reverse psychology.
We'll come back and talk some more with Colby Bazell and Jack Lewis, both featured in America at a Crossroads, Operation Homecoming, Writing the Wartime Experience. It'll be on the week of April 15th on PBS. This is the Paul Harris Show on KMOX. In the studio today with Colby Bazell and Jack Lewis, two guys who not only served in Iraq but also wrote about their experiences while they were there. Colby started a blog that got him quite a bit of notoriety and then shut down by the Army. Or did the Army give you permission to keep writing but limit what you could write about, or did they say, that's it, stay away from the laptop, stay away from the computer?
Both. At first I had to have my writing looked over by a platoon sergeant and higher before posting it on the internet, and, you know, I didn't want to waste his time over there, you know. I mean, we all joined to be in the Army to go fight in the war, and, you know, I didn't want him to play editor on the side, so, you know, and, yeah, so.
After a while, you just stopped?
Yeah, I just decided to stop.
But you did compile some of what you blogged about into a book.
Correct. At the time, I was getting a lot of emails, and I was also getting emails from people suggesting that I, you know, I should write a book. So what I did was I compiled all my blogs, and you know, just wrote from the beginning what led me to join the Army to the end, and just put it out.
The book is called My War. Are you still in the military?
No.
You're done with that, huh?
Correct.
Rearview mirror.
Yeah.
How about you, Jack?
Am I done?
Yeah.
I'm pretty well done. I'm 43 years old, and I just don't have the knees for that anymore.
Mm-hmm. And you had served in Korea, right?
Not the war.
No, not the Korean War.
Not old.
But,
in the early 80s, right?
You had, yeah, you had, 83.
You'd been there. And what was the story with when you were writing over there? Did people come to you and say, knock it off?
No, I was... I got to admit, I was pretty sub rosa about it. I just kept sending the stuff off as emails. One of my ulterior motives was actually to shine things up a little bit so the people I cared about wouldn't be afraid for me.
Mm.
So I was pretty confident that I wasn't divulging anything that was going to get anybody hurt or embarrass anyone.
Mm-hmm.
You're being reassuring.
Most of the time, yeah.
Yeah.
And you said to me off the air, you two were here talking about it, and many have, but you said to me it's okay because I have family, and you said it's okay that they not talk about it. You can just hug them, and that's advice, because we want to know.
Yeah,
there's a part of us that wants to know exactly what happened and how you made it through and what happened on that night and that fight. And
I guess it's maybe the difference between accepting what somebody has to say, which is always good, and sort of actively trying to draw folks out, which for a lot of us doesn't work that well.
Because it was very different in Vietnam, as we all know. I mean, those men came back and they shut
nobody
down.
Wanted to know.
Nobody wanted to know.
Even World War II veterans don't want to talk about it. My dad never wanted to talk about his experiences, or my father-in-law either. So
they're the men in the gray flannel suit.
Yeah, and here you are, two guys who were actively telling your stories to people back home. And I want to ask you about one other aspect of this. I was talking on the show a couple of weeks ago to a Marine lieutenant who served in Iraq, and I asked him about the notion of the United States military as a police force, which is essentially, especially some of the urban areas, what you guys are doing. And he said, you know, I was trained to shoot and kill, not to build schools and make sure that intersections were clear. Was that true for you also, Colby?
Yeah, that was exactly pretty much all we did over there. When I was there for the second year of the war, so it was pretty much police work, doing presence patrols, doing counter-mortar observation posts. It's just police work, winning hearts and minds, something we were never been trained on until you get there, and all of a sudden they tell you, you know, start, you know, telling you about this hearts and minds stuff, and it's like, how do you do that? You know, all the training that we've done before that, even the urban combat training was very limited. It's pretty much you learn while you're there how to survive.
Did you think that's the wrong role for the U.S. military? That this is where the Iraqis need to step up and take care of their own intersections?
Correct. That's the way I look at it. You know, the whole time there, I was like thinking, you know, why am I doing this? You know, shouldn't these guys over here, these Iraqi police and the Army, shouldn't they be doing this sort of stuff? You know, but, you know.
Jack, why weren't they doing that and still aren't doing that in many places?
Well, it may be that we've simply got ourselves into a position of you broke it, you bought it.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to help pick up the pieces a little bit.
You think the Iraqis may be a little bit too dependent on us because of that?
I think the Iraqis tend to be dependent on whoever has the biggest fist.
Mm. You know, why die if this American will die for me? You know, why am I going to get shot and killed when these Americans will go ahead and do it for me? You know, kind of thing.
So are they incapable or unwilling?
I think they're a little bit willing to displace responsibility if we let them.
Mm. Well, guys, you tell remarkable stories, and I'm glad they got included in this PBS documentary. It's called Operation Homecoming. It's not just the two of you, but a bunch of people who have served over there, who wrote about their experiences at the time, are included in this. And it's just one of the at least 10 hours that will be included in this PBS series called America at a Crossroads. It airs the week of April 15th, Channel 9 here in the St. Louis area and PBS stations all across the country. Thank you so much for your service and for your time today.
Thanks for your time.
Colby Bazell and Jack Lewis here on the Paul Harris Show. It's News Talk 1120 KMOX.